Welcome to Australia's Future with Tony Abbott. I'm Daniel Wilde from the Institute of Public Affairs. Australia is facing its most significant challenges since World War II. Geopolitical tensions are increasing, cultural self-confidence is in decline. The values which define us, freedom, democracy, egalitarianism, and sacrifice, are being put to the test. Over this special podcast series, Tony and I discuss how Australia can survive and flourish in the decades ahead. Well, hello, Tony, and g'day to all of our listeners. Great to be back for another episode of Australia's Future with Tony Abbott. Today, we'll be talking about Australia's energy situation and the transition potentially to nuclear technology. We'll be discussing the voice to Parliament and the so-called fact-checking that's taking place and the big tech censorship, and also getting Tony's observation and thoughts about the broader context within which the voice to Parliament debate is taking place. Tony, nice to be back with you.
Dan, thanks for having me, and it's great to be back with our viewers.
Great, pleasure. So, Tony, let's kick off with the energy debate. Last time we talked about the situation in Victoria, the banning on gas and the broader issues there. I think the Coalition is starting to provide some pretty important leadership on the energy debate. Recently, we've had the Shadow Energy Minister, Ted O'Brien, making the observation about the nuclear, the coal to nuclear transition that's been taking place in some parts of the United States. Reporting last week by Jeff Chambers in The Australian says a coal to nuclear transition in the regions, tapping Australia's world-leading uranium stocks, affirming as centerpieces of the Coalition's 2025 energy policy. Tony, this is, I think, a pretty positive development. What are your thoughts?
Well, if we are going to achieve net zero and keep the lights on, the only way to do so is through nuclear power. We don't have the kind of hydro resources that a country like New Zealand or even a state like Tasmania has. So if we are going to get to net zero using proven technology, because of our what Mother Nature has given us, nuclear is the only way to go. I guess it's always been a bit incongruous that with some of the world's largest uranium reserves, we've been prepared to send the uranium offshore but not to use it for power here, particularly given that since the 1950s we've had a nuclear reactor at Lucas Heights in Sydney to provide medical isotopes, PEP scanning and various forms of cancer treatment are only possible thanks to the nuclear reactor at Lucas Heights, and that's been operating safely, as I say, for 60-odd years in Sydney's backyard. So, look, this whole nuclear phobia is completely misplaced. Now that we're going to get, eventually at least, nuclear-powered submarines, it seems entirely unreasonable to say that it's okay to have nuclear power tied up at a wharf, but it's not okay to have nuclear power sitting next door on land. So good on the Coalition for moving inexorably, if at times somewhat slowly, towards what I think is a common sense position. The pity is that we didn't move this way as soon as we started to get anxious about the use of coal and gas. Now, personally, I don't think we should be anxious about the use of coal and gas. Gas has 50% the emissions of coal, and modern coal-fired power stations have only 50% of the emissions of the ones we mostly still have. So I think it's possible to quite substantially reduce your emissions and continue to use fossil fuels. But if we do have to get to net zero, there's no doubt nuclear is the way to go. But before we get to nuclear, we've got to cope with keeping the lights on, maintaining jobs, keeping industries present in this country. And that is a huge challenge, given the slow-motion train wreck that is existing energy policy.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean, even if the ban on nuclear power was removed tomorrow, it would take many years to get plants set up. So we have to, if we are going to transition in this way, we still have to keep the existing coal-fired power stations open. And I agree. I think the high-efficiency, low-emissions coal, the ultra-supercritical coal stations, to me, that should be a part of the energy mix as well.
Well, I agree, Dan. And I think the first thing that's needed with energy is to say that no coal-fired power stations will henceforth be allowed to shut until there is a reliable alternative in place. Second, I think we have to say, look, we are definitely opening some of these new gas fields, Narrabri, Beetaloo, Browse, quite apart from our own domestic needs, which will increase if we are to further electrify, as many governments seem to think we must. But quite apart from that, we need to be a secure source of gas to our major friends and allies like the Japanese and the Koreans. So look, for all sorts of reasons, it's essential that we don't just jeopardise our own power supply in the short term by further coal closures. We've actually got to secure our power supply in the medium term with more gas. And then in the longer term, we need to give ourselves at least the option of going nuclear. One point I should make, though, about nuclear power, we've had effectively small modular reactors operating safely at sea for the best part of seven decades. And there really should be no technical difficulties with creating land-based modular reactors. Yeah. And why we have to have the regulatory constraints around them is I think, again, somewhat puzzling, given that they've successfully operated at sea for so long. There's only one nuclear-powered vessel that's ever been lost at sea. Sorry, there's only one Western nuclear-powered vessel that's ever been lost at sea. Mm-hmm. And while obviously that's a concern, these reactors are very, very safe.
Yeah, and that goes to this issue, or not so much issue, but the public support for nuclear. Mm-hmm. Historically, it's been quite low in Australia for various reasons. It tends to be higher among the younger generation, because they were brought up in a time when you didn't have the sort of scare campaigns, or not just scare, there were legitimate concerns around the storage of nuclear waste and so forth. And I don't want to diminish the genuine concerns that are out there. Polling that we did put it at about 51% support. Interestingly, also a poll that was released a couple of days ago also had it at about 51% support. So there's a majority, and about 30% are unsure. So there's a lot of persuadable people. So I guess what the coalition is doing is saying, look, we've got already got 50% in the bank. There's 30% that are open. So if we get another 20 out of that 30, then we've got a strong policy. Based on, I mean, you're probably one of the most successful leaders of a political party to persuade the public to come with you on the carbon tax, for example. What's your perspective on how to get that 30% into the yes column on this?
Well, we've just got to keep talking about it. And it's the old story, when you are sick to death of something and are, as it were, bored saying it, the public are just starting to wake up to it. And you know, what is regarded as politically impossible one moment, the next moment might turn out to be pushing on an open door. Take at a different level, admittedly, the question of Sydney's second airport. Remember when Gough Whitlam first proposed the second airport at Sydney, I can remember a ferocious campaign against it was going to be up at Goulston for some reason, and there were all these stickers saying, birds not Boeings at Goulston. Yeah. And then when the Howard government proposed it back in about the early 2000s, again there was a ferocious campaign against it. Yeah. But when I committed us to doing it in late 2013, there was hardly any opposition at all. I mean, there was an initial flurry of self-interested activists, but generally speaking, people said, well, actually, about time, particularly when I pitched it as as the airport for Western Sydney. So it wasn't a second airport for Sydney. It was giving Western Sydney something that the rest of Sydney had already had for generations, and that was finally going to go to them. So look, I think we might surprise ourselves just how little opposition there is to the ending of the nuclear ban if and when it finally comes forward from a major political party.
And, of course, the hard part, if we get to that point, would be getting it through the Senate, because who knows? And your government put a lot of important reforms through the lower house, got stuck in the Senate. I mean, who knows what will happen there?
But it would certainly be desirable for the political party that wants to end the nuclear ban to take it to an election clearly saying that this is a key policy. This is absolutely critical if we are to keep the lights on while getting eventually to net zero. And I hope that that is in fact what we see, a major political party taking this to an election and putting it up in flashing neon lights and doing the hard yards of persuading the Australian public that this is really the way to go, and that all of those anxieties and fears that for years were fed to us were never as credible as people once thought.
Yeah, and of course, one of the other key points of differentiation in that case, if the coalition were to have a nuclear policy in this coal to nuclear transition, is you wouldn't need this rewiring the nation policy of Labor's, which is almost just as bad as everything else in our energy policy, with the transmission lines and the solar panels and the wind turbines going up in regional communities on prime agricultural farmland, often without adequate community consultation. So this is a really, I think, a big issue as well that's becoming more heated. Just interested in your perspective on that particular matter.
Couldn't agree with you more, Dan. I have always thought wind turbines are the satanic mills of the modern era. I've always thought that. And just recently we had the former chief scientist publish a book where he talked about our future of literally forests of wind turbines and fields of solar panels stretching as far as the eye can see. Net zero has calculated, and this is a sort of a pro-renewable power entity, but an intellectually respectable one. Net zero has calculated that to give ourselves sufficient renewable energy to get to net zero will take an extraordinary landmass. Half the size of Victoria will have to be covered with solar panels in order to get us there, says net zero. Now, I think this is an absolutely dystopian future. The idea that the Australian landscape, or indeed anything of beauty, should be littered with wind turbines and solar panels, I just find it repugnant, absolutely repugnant. And then, of course, as you say, there are these giant transmission towers marching across the countryside. And because renewables are only operational for 30% of the time, there's the multi-billion dollar expense of building all these transmission lines, which even the Labor Party costed at $80 billion pre-election, and we all know how unreliable these costings are. There's the multi-billion dollar cost of these things, and they're only going to be actually operating roughly 30% of the time. So this is an extraordinary burden we're putting on ourselves.
It is, and look, good on the coalition for getting into this debate. I think it's important, so let's hope it keeps up. Tony, speaking of things which are repugnant, we've got this big situation of big tech censorship that we've been discussing for a while, which is related to the fact-checking. Very briefly, just for our listeners and viewers, as you know, Facebook censors content fairly extensively. One of the ways that they do that is through detecting misinformation, and they will say something is misinformation or misleading or false based on fact-checking that's undertaken by organisations such as AAP and also the RMIT ABC fact-check unit. So there's been many fact-checks. Viewers will know that the IPA has been censored on many such occasions. Tony, there's been a couple of more fact-checking issues. The first pertains to basically Peter Credlin's work in uncovering that the Uluru Statement from the Heart is not one page, but it's 18 pages plus. Mm-hmm. So they fact-checked that particular information. And look, the issue here is that, as I say, this so-called fact-checking then ends up suppressing information on social media, I would argue deliberately to reduce the content that people can see. So, Tony, interested in your perspective on this issue.
Dan, I think it's wicked, really, that there is an attempt by big tech to censor things because people in the Yes campaign deny today what they asserted yesterday.
That's right.
We've got Megan Davis and Pat Anderson, two of the principal authors of the Uluru Statement from the Heart, saying today that it's just one page, just 439 words to help the Prime Minister out of a hole he created for himself, when for years, Megan Davis in particular, but Pat Anderson also, were insisting, absolutely insisting, that the Statement from the Heart was many, many pages, 18 to 20 plus pages. Now, I just don't know how these people can look at themselves in the mirror without blushing with embarrassment right now. I mean, Megan Davis said in her Parks oration in 2018 that it's a common mistake to think that this thing is one page. In fact, it's 18 to 20 pages. Pat Anderson co-chaired the Referendum Council, and the Referendum Council, yes, published at the very beginning of its final report the one-page version of the Uluru Statement, that kind of artwork version with the statement in the middle, some Indigenous artwork around the margins, and all of the of the signatures of the attendees at the Uluru Convention. They published that version, but then from page 16 of the full report, there's about 12 highlighted pages which are stated in the final report of the Referendum Council. They're stated to be extracts from the Uluru Statement from the Heart. Now, Pat Anderson signed the letter as co-chair releasing the final report, which says here are 16 pages of extracts or a dozen pages of extracts, rather, from page 16 of the report from the Statement from the Heart. Now, you just can't assert one thing when it's convenient and a different thing when the convenience changes, when the politics changes. And obviously right now, millions of Australians are starting to get quite anxious about The Voice because they're waking up to the fact that it's not just The Voice, it's Voice Treaty Truth. It's not just recognition, it's power too. And then to have big tech coming in and trying to stop organisations from publishing the fact that the Statement from the Heart is much more than the 439 words that the Prime Minister loves to refer to, so much more, including a lot of very dark stuff, very dark, if I may say so, claims about our history. Now, I certainly don't say that our history is without blemish, but this idea that it's just an unrelieved story of frontier wars, poisonings, genocide, this evil time, as the Our Story version of the Statement from Our Heart, or the Our Story segment of the Statement from Our Heart asserts, it's just not right. It's certainly not the whole picture. And I think that people need to know just how angry and, dare I say, grievance fixated the authors of the Statement from the Heart often were.
Well, that's right. And you've had people like Marsha Langdon explicitly say our constitution is racist. And of course, she's the author, co-author of the Karma Langdon Report. Now, on the issue of treaty, I'm interested to get your perspective on this. My opinion of The Voice, its purpose is to be the counterparty to the treaty that they want, because you can't really have a treaty with several hundred entities. So my opinion is that's the explicit intent of The Voice, is to be that counterparty. And the reason they want a treaty is because they believe our constitution is racist. And so the treaty would be our second constitution. And I think everything before that essentially would be, if not nullified, then heavily contested. So that's why this is such an important issue. It's not about, in one sense, it doesn't matter whether it's one page, 10 pages or 30 pages. It's to get to the point that there is a much bigger agenda at play here. And they're going at great lengths to cover this up because, as you say, there are many of, I'm not saying all of them, but certainly many of the activists and certainly many of those who have played a key part in the architecture of The Voice really hold the view that we are an illegitimate nation with a racist constitution, and they basically want to undo all of that. So, look, just very keen on your perspective of the stakes of this issue.
Again, if you read the full statement, there are sentences in there to the effect that the invasion that started in 1788 is our fundamental grievance against the Crown. Mm. And there are statements in there to the effect that the whole point of The Voice is to start this treaty-making process, culminating in what they describe as a Makarrata Commission. And Makarrata is a Yolngu word. It's not about reconciliation as we might understand it. It's a Yolngu word, which the ABC told us some years ago, refers to a kind of retribution ritual, I think Peter Credlin called it in a piece the other day. It's a ceremonial but disabling spearing that is supposed to happen to someone who's committed some major crime. So this Makarrata Commission, it's effectively a form of payback punishment. I think that's what Peter Credlin said in her piece. And I think that's absolutely right. And again, this puts this whole voice debate into a very different context than that which the Prime Minister likes to push. A day or so back on Sydney Radio, he was talking about the full richness of our history. Well, I don't know that anyone reading the full Uluru Statement would think that what they're talking about is richness. Mm-hmm. I think you can only conclude that what they're talking about there is injustice, oppression. They even use the word genocide. Now, I think the PM is really, I would hate to think that he hasn't actually read it himself, but I think he's misread it, definitely misread it, if he thinks it's talking about the richness of our history as opposed to a rather one-sided view of our history as nothing but, or almost nothing but, a story of dispossession, persecution and discrimination.
Mm, and that's why this referendum is really a turning point, or in my view, because we've got to do, it was almost like the defeat of bank nationalisation and the victory of Menzies. It was essentially two roads you could go down. And I think we're at a similar point now where you've got one very different view of our nation, our history and our culture, which cannot coexist with our liberal democratic constitutional, conventional approach to governance. Mm-hmm. They're sort of mutually incompatible. And I think as Australians are sort of beginning to understand the significance, the Prime Minister will say, oh, it's just a modest request. Mm-hmm. But we know it's far more than that. So I'd just be interested to get your reflections on, there's The Voice, but then there's also this much bigger, mm-hmm. I think it's a big historical cultural moment that we're now facing, and if you could speak to the significance of this referendum and what it means for the future.
There's no doubt that this is the biggest constitutional change we've ever been asked to make. We're not here just adding modestly to the powers of the federal government, which is pretty much what all other changes except 1967, including 1967, were about. This doesn't just add to the powers of the federal government. This significantly changes our system of government. As Professors Aroni and Gerangelos said to the Parliamentary Committee couple of months back, it's a fourth arm of government being inserted into our constitution. And unlike 1967, where the big agenda was to remove division, to welcome Indigenous people fully into the Australian family, this is actually to create division, to say that there are some Australians who are more special than others because their ancestry goes back tens of thousands of years. Their ancestry in this country goes back tens of thousands of years rather than simply since 1788 and subsequently. And yes, it is an attempt to, as far as is possible, re-Indigenise Australia. And some of the things that we've seen in recent times, the near ubiquity of acknowledgements of country, the near ubiquity of the flying of the Indigenous, the Aboriginal flag and the Torres Strait Islander flag too often, co-equally with the national flag, these cultural sensitivity workshops that just about every large company insists now that its employees go through. And what we've started to see is renamings. I can't help but notice that you'll look at posters now for sporting events that will talk about not just Sydney but Gadigal, not just Melbourne but Naam, not just Brisbane, but Meanjin. I got on a plane in Perth the other day, and at times the departure board didn't say Sydney, it said Gadigal. And this is how these things kind of sneak in. And if the voice comes to pass, this whole thing is going to be absolutely turbocharged because you're right, Dan. The authors of The Voice, want to see the Australian equivalent of the Treaty of Waitangi. Only the Treaty of Waitangi was at the beginning of New Zealand's history. This is, if you like, trying to turn back the clock 240-odd years with Waitangi-type treaties between the Australian government as the successor of the British Crown, between the Australian government and all of the various Indigenous nations, as they call them now, or clans and tribes, which were in possession of the Australian landmass prior to settlement in 1788. So it's a very, very big deal indeed. And I think it's a step backwards. I think it's a step in the wrong direction. I think it's a step away from the kind of liberal humanity which has always characterised Australia at its best.
Well, that's right. We can't turn back the clock, but we can look to the future. And I think one of the proposals you've put forward in terms of how to achieve reconciliation has been some form of recognition in the Constitution. I think this would be a good note to close on. Yourself and John Howard and others have supported some form of recognition in the Constitution. I think that still comes with risks because we have historically had a fairly activist High Court, so I don't think it's a risk-free proposal, but certainly it's in a completely different category than the voice to Parliament. So perhaps we could just finish on what in terms of how do we achieve reconciliation, presumably recognition is a part of that, if you could elaborate on your thinking in that space.
Well, yes, Dan. Since John Howard put this on our national agenda in the run-up to the 2007 election, I've been happy to concede that we could complete the Constitution, if you like, rather than change it, with an acknowledgement, a suitable acknowledgement that Aboriginal people were here first. Now, I reckon there are three possibilities, broadly. If we ever really felt that we had to have some Indigenous entity in the Constitution, and I'm surprised that voice architects such as Julian Lisa and or voice advocates such as Julian Lisa and Greg Craven haven't mentioned this, you could say, for argument's sake, that prior to any exercise of the Commonwealth's power under Section 5126, the so-called race power, there must be a consultation with Indigenous groups. You could say something like that. Or you could put in some appropriate part of the Constitution something reflecting the Indigenous Recognition Act, an act that was passed without dissent by the Parliament in 2013, in my time as opposition leader. Or my own preference, my very strong preference, would be to insert in the preamble, after the words "one indissoluble federal commonwealth," these new words: "with an Indigenous heritage, a British foundation, and an immigrant character," because all those three things are indubitably true. Taken together, it would make indigeneity one of the three pillars on which modern Australia is based, and it would be a change to our constitution, an improvement arguably to our constitution, a grace note certainly in our constitution. That's got something for everyone. And in the end, successful constitutions have got to belong to the whole people. And successful constitutional change has got to have something in it for everyone. And at the moment, that is most definitely not the case with this voice.
Well, Tony, on that note, we might end it there. And I think after all this division, it might be good to have a proposal that could conceivably unite the country. But we'll see how that goes. So, Tony, appreciate your time and insights as always. And thank you for being with us.
And I look forward to talking again in a couple of weeks' time. Thanks, Dan.
This is a production of the Centre for the Australian Way of Life at the Institute of Public Affairs. To find out more, visit australia.ipa.org.au.